Welcome to Parent Talk. I'm your host, Vidya. As always, this is our live show and our call-in number is 510-770-1550. Today, we're going to be talking about a very, very important subject and one that our Indian community in particular needs to pay attention to. It's a fact that the number of kids with developmental disabilities is steadily going up. But the good news is that if we address the issue early enough, we can really make a difference in our child's life. I'll be talking to two experts today who are in the best position to assess what a child's developmental needs are and what kind of services will help. My guests today are Michelle Oliver, Program Specialist for the Santa Clara County Office of Education's Early Start Program, and Howard Doy, who is currently a District Manager for the Early Start Program at the San Andreas Regional Center. Welcome to the program, Michelle and Howard.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Michelle, as a specialist in the area, you emphasize the importance of being very aware of your young child's growth and development. So what are the milestones that act as indicators for the child's well-being?
Well, for a child birth to three, some of the things that you would want to look for is, are they sitting independently by 6 to 9 months? Are they walking by 12 to 16 months? Mm-hmm. And by age two, a child should have consistently 10 to 20 words that they're able to use on their own.
Isn't this something that the pediatrician would anyway look over during the child's well check? Why does the parent have to be a little vigilant as well?
Well, it brings up a really good point. Unfortunately, pediatricians have about an average of 7 minutes during a well child check. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, during recent studies in the American Journal of Developmental Pediatrics, they're showing that most pediatricians feel like they don't have enough time, there isn't adequate reimbursement, mm-hmm. and they're not sufficiently trained on developmental screenings. So we typically have about 1.8% of children in early intervention services, mm-hmm. but 5% of children in services
actually need them?
Well, no, 5% of kids are identified by age three. So we're missing a whole population of kids that we could be intervening on during birth to three.
So the best person to judge whether the child's development is proceeding on track is the parent? Is that what you'd say?
In my opinion, a parent's intuition is the best indicator. If a parent feels like something isn't right, mm-hmm. then they should utilize the services that are available for an assessment.
Now, I want to move to the assessment part. Another interesting that I heard about the assessment thing that I had discussed with you earlier is that anybody can actually, before the age of three, say, sort of flag the issue. Is that right?
Absolutely. Under the age of three, a referral can come from a pediatrician, a public health nurse, a parent, a grandmother, a child care provider. It's always voluntary on the part of the parent once we get a referral to follow through on an assessment, but it's your tax dollars at work. There's no charge for the assessment, and it's always a parent's choice to choose if they want to pursue any recommendations that we make.
So the referral, as you're calling it, is basically calling up a regional center and saying, I think there may be an issue with the development of my child and I want to look it over. And Howard, here's where I would like your input. What is the regional center? I don't think many people even know of the existence of an organization like that.
Yes, the regional center is a system of 21 centers throughout the state of California. It was designed basically to support people and families with developmental disabilities. Mm-hmm. And it originally started as an act called the Lanterman Act in the late 60s. And from that, this whole developmental support system through the regional center system occurred.
So it's a federally funded program, or a state funded program?
Through Early Start, it's a federal funded program, yes. And then the regional center also gets funding through the state of California.
So just walk me through what a parent would do, that a parent who believed, or maybe referred to by the pediatrician or somebody, the parent has a flag, red flag showing up saying, okay, I think that maybe there's an issue going on with my child. What would the next step be?
So I just want to clarify too that I'm going to speak to Santa Clara County because here, in this county, there's another regional center called the Regional Center of the East Bay.
Right.
In Santa Clara County, it's the San Andreas Regional Center. And there's a little bit, every regional center runs their process a little bit differently.
Okay.
Based upon what the need of the community. So, I can only kind of address what's happening in Santa Clara County.
Which are the big cities that your regional center covers?
So basically we cover from Palo Alto, mm-hmm. All the way down to Morgan Hill and Gilroy.
So San Jose, Cupertino, Sunnyvale,
yes. everything in between.
And everything in between is covered by a regional center. And just to clarify for our listeners, there is, for people maybe who are listening from Fremont or north of Fremont and around Fremont, the regional center would be the regional center of the East Bay.
That is correct.
So, yes, again, walk me through what would happen for somebody in your area.
Okay, so basically we have developed a warm line referral, and that number is 800-404-5900.
Now, can you repeat that?
Sure. It's 800-404-5900.
Mm-hmm.
And as Michelle was saying, that basically anybody can make a referral to that number.
What does making a referral mean?
It's basically meaning that, you may, if you're a professional, you may see a child that is showing some delays,
mm-hmm.
and that you're concerned about that, and you go ahead and make that referral. But again, it could be a parent that's concerned. It could be a public health nurse. It could be anybody, really.
And they would just call in and speak to whom?
So typically, they would probably leave a message, and they would get back to you within a certain period of time, and they'll do some screening with that person about the referral.
So what would probably happen is that somebody from the regional center would call the parent back, mm-hmm. and talk to them about the child. And Michelle, is that something mm-hmm. that you would be doing, or somebody in under your supervision would be doing?
Correct. So the team Howard talked about, where we have a unique situation in Santa Clara County where early start services between the regional centers and the education system collaborate very well.
Mm-hmm.
So families only have to go through one central referral number that Howard mentioned. So when a family calls or we get a fax from a pediatrician, the families returned the call within 48 hours.
Okay.
Then we do some paperwork with the family to get more information on the child's development. From the time we get that referral, we have 45 days to meet with that family,
mm-hmm.
to look at the child's development, talk to the family about what their concerns are, recommend if the child is eligible for services, and then actually develop a plan of service.
Mm-hmm.
We're federally mandated to do all of that within 45 days.
I want to talk a little bit more about, what are the typical things that parents come to you, what are the typical flags, red flags that they bring to you. Michelle, just continuing our conversation from before the break, what are the typical red flags that parents come to the center with, or parents come to the Early Start program with?
Communicating.
Isn't speaking.
Mm-hmm. We get a lot of referrals for parents that are concerned about their child possibly being on the autism spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a population of kids that just seem to have a developmental delay in some area. Maybe they're not sitting up like they should. But the most common referral is communication concerns.
So do you find that parents today are much more aware than they were a few years ago about the fact that there are, developmental issues, and they're a little more educated about the subject?
I think absolutely parents are more educated. In addition, I think the medical community is being much more proactive in their referrals. When we started doing the joint assessments with the regional center 14 years ago, we had 700 referrals. Last year, we had over 2,000 referrals and assessed over 1,600 children in Santa Clara County. So
that's,
we're definitely broadening the net of families that we're able to help.
And this is more a function of people being more aware of developmental delays, or is it that there are more kids falling into that pool?
I think there's no way to answer that question and know that you're right. I am optimistic that it's that we're being more aware and identifying things earlier.
Now, tell me a little bit about the Early Start program. Typically, Howard, as I understand it, once the people at the regional center have done their assessment and come to the conclusion that there is indeed something that can be done to help the child, and this can be probably in a variety of areas like behavior or speech or communication, whatever. So they would be referred to the Early Start program. Am I correct?
That's correct.
So when they come to the Early Start program, what are the typical kinds of things that are available through the program for kids with developmental disability?
So through the regional center, every family is assigned a caseworker. They're called service coordinators.
Mm-hmm.
And basically they help that family to guide them through the system. And all information goes through that. I mean, the service coordinator is every 6 months we have an update of the family service plan.
Mm-hmm.
So they're in charge of that, and also helping the family to transition to the local school district after 3.
Okay.
Which is an important part of the process, where they start process 2. So In addition to, they help set up the services. For instance, if a child, as Michelle was speaking about, has a communication delay, then mm-hmm. when we look at speech therapy for that child, mm-hmm. Could be occupational therapy, physical therapy, an early intervention or specialist too. They go into the home. We have center-based programs. So it just really depends on the assessed need of that child and family.
So you provide occupational. Could you just repeat what are the kind of services that, mm-hmm. and is it through the Early Start program, Michelle, or is it through the regional center? Or is it like a teamwork mm-hmm. that there's somebody does something and some...
Well, I think it's important to keep in mind that for birth to three, the regional center is providing Early Start services. So they're not really two separate entities until after the age of three.
Okay.
So you're in Early Start if you've been identified with a developmental delay or an established risk factor like Down syndrome when your child is birth to three. Whether your services are through the regional center or the education system doesn't really matter. It's, are you getting the appropriate services? So it's still considered Early Start. Mm-hmm. Even if the regional center is providing the services. So a child could be getting physical therapy, occupational therapy, speech and language therapy, a developmental specialist coming into the home, which we call early intervention. Some children are getting behavioral services, and then some children are in center-based programs. Typically, the children that we've identified having more intensive needs and are more likely to continue to need services at the age of three mm-hmm. are typically the kiddos that we might recommend for more intensive center-based services.
Okay. You know, but still, it boggles the mind that we're talking about really, really young children here. They're 0 to 3. I mean, they're like really, is it, well, from my experience, most parents don't even have a clue till the child is 3 or so, and then they're not walking yet, they're not talking yet. But how do you identify that early? How can the parent be expected to know that there is something going on?
Well, you would hope between the parents' intuition and guidance from friends and family and pediatricians that we would be able to identify things early. We're really finding whether it's medical issues or developmental issues, parents' instincts are the highest appropriately indicator of an issue. So if we can intervene early on a kiddo who's not crawling yet or a kiddo at age 2 who isn't talking, the thing that makes early intervention so amazing is that it isn't about the therapy with the child. It's the support that we're giving the parents and caregivers. Mm-hmm. You can have a child having therapy 5 days a week, and if the family doesn't take that information home and implement it, it really isn't that effective. So why early intervention works is that it's really a family service plan mm-hmm. where you're supporting the family, giving them the support and the skills that they need to help their child reach their developmental potential 7 days a week.
So what you're saying is that one of the core components of your program is to train the parents themselves and make sure that, and I think this would be helpful even when it comes to, okay, them being able to monitor it going forward, to monitor the child's progress going forward, and if anything else, any other issues come up. Did you have something to say?
Yeah, that's very true because, you know, obviously parents, we don't get trained to be with developmental backgrounds.
Right.
And we don't have that information. But so and that's one of the main reasons why, yeah, the intervention is to support the parent, to help support their child and building this relationship with their child too as well. So this is a long-term kind of thing that, as you say, that will be a best support for them.
Now, you know, especially in Indian families and even otherwise, kids have a wide spectrum of development. And for instance, a child may not be speaking, but you may get some advice from a family member that, you know, your uncle didn't speak till he was 3 and then we couldn't get him to shut up and things like that. So you'll be getting a lot of conflicting advice saying, don't worry, it will improve. So at that point, does the parent, you know, wait or does the parent say it's okay to, I'd rather be sure. I'd rather go check it out. What would you advise the parent at that point?
My advice is if the parent themselves has any question, that they follow through with the assessment. Like I mentioned before the first break, as a parent, you have the right to an assessment. There's no charge for it. It is still your choice at the end of that assessment if you even want to pursue any services with Early Start. So for the peace of mind, that's an option that's there for you. Some parents, because they don't want to become what they consider part of the system, mm-hmm. will go out and pursue private assessments through developmental clinics, and they can pay up to $1,500 for those. So, and all that developmental clinic will do, while they'll give you very good information, they will then tell you to come to us for services. So my recommendation for families is to bypass that system,
mm-hmm.
utilize something that you're already paying for with your tax money, and just have the assessment and see what the results are.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
And I think the other thing to keep in mind, though, is if you're not concerned, if you were a late talker, your child's not getting frustrated, he's able to communicate really well through gestures, trust your intuition.
Mm-hmm.
Because the assessment process, to be honest, for some families can be very stressful. So if you're feeling okay and your child isn't experiencing frustration, then sometimes it is okay to hold off a little bit. But when you're talking about a child who's maybe lost some skills,
okay.
You have concern about not only communication but social development.
Mm-hmm.
Then that's a different ballgame, and you really want to have it looked at.
And when you said, you know, parents don't want their child to get into the system, and I totally sort of in a gut sense that I sort of get it, because it's something that certainly parents are afraid of getting that label. Can you elaborate on why that's not a big issue? Getting into the system. What are the parents' rights? What are the child's rights at this point?
Well, basically, parents have a right to request for assessments to be done on their child. And again, mm-hmm. if they do qualify, to have services that basically are free of cost.
I want to just emphasize that to our listeners,
yeah.
that services through the regional center for 0 to 3 are free of cost.
Well, that's been changed a little bit with the legislation that's passed, that we have to actually look at insurance to possibly pay for certain services, such as occupational therapy, physical therapy, speech and language, and the more intensive service for those kids who may be on the spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
We have to look at.
And what if the parent doesn't have insurance or can't afford it? Is it available to parents in that case?
So that's part of our responsibility to help parents to find some public support through that area too as well. So we will help the family in that way.
We'll help the family. Yes, but continue. We were talking about getting into the system. You know, what happens if the parent comes in, the child is assessed, you make a diagnosis which the parent is not comfortable with or doesn't agree with.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it happens. Actually, in my own case, when my son was eventually diagnosed, there were some components to the diagnosis from the regional center that I didn't agree with.
Mm-hmm.
So what are the parents' rights at that point in time?
Well, again, you know, the parents always have a right not to pursue services too as well. If they feel like initially that maybe too that their assessment is not correct,
mm-hmm.
I mean, they're welcome to go outside and get another assessment if they want to too as well.
Mm-hmm.
And parents have done that. So, I mean, it's not like they are kind of stuck with this. I mean,
okay,
there are alternatives to kind of look at and negotiate and talk to our team too as well.
Before the show, we were talking about getting the child assessed early, and I want to just clarify at this time what it means when you go to the regional center. And what I understand is that going to the regional center doesn't mean you're going to get a diagnosis, and that's what we were talking about during the break. And I want Michelle, why don't you elaborate on that why going to Early Start or at least availing of the services of Early Start is such a safe thing for the parent to do.
When we assess a child and make a recommendation for services based on finding a developmental issue when we do the assessment, we're going to provide those services for the child under a developmental delay, and they may be given what we call an education category.
Mm-hmm.
That is very different than going to a neurologist and getting a medical diagnosis, such as autism.
What is an education category? Can you give me an example of an education category?
So there's 13 federal education classifications. The most common ones used in birth to three are speech and language impairment,
mm-hmm.
intellectual disability, autism, and other health impairment.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's some of the more low incidence, such as a child who's born with a vision impairment or deaf, hard of hearing.
Okay. Continue. You were talking about how it differs from a diagnosis and how it's mm-hmm. not a diagnosis, really.
Right. So let's say, for example, I assess a child who's 21 months old and there's significant delays in communication and social skills.
Mm-hmm.
And I need to explain to that family, I know you came in for communication concerns, but we're noticing the team issues in numerous areas. And some of these are red flags specifically for children who might be on the autism spectrum.
Okay.
And that I'll share with them, because we need to be forthright with what we're seeing, that I think the most appropriate education category to get your child services is autism.
Okay.
The reason why identifying the appropriate ed category is important is that to get that child the intensive level of services that I need,
mm-hmm.
he has to be under that education category.
Now, the parents at that point may have had some diagnosis from their pediatrician or somebody, a specialist that their pediatrician referred to them to like a neurologist. And maybe that diagnosis is different. What happens in that case?
So there definitely have been times where a parent comes to us saying they've been to a neurologist who says the child has autism or pervasive developmental disorder, and our assessment results don't agree with that.
Okay.
We don't feel, based on what we've seen, that the child would fit under an education category of autism. But we do see that there's a communication delay, and our recommendation initially might be an early interventionist working with the family one or two times a week in the home, and also seeing a speech therapist once a week.
Does it matter at this point what the label is? Because I think one of the things that especially parents in our community are very concerned about, the fact that they don't want their child to get a label, and it's a big, big issue. And I think that probably prevents a lot of us from approaching and asking for help, because we are praying and hoping that whatever is going on with the child fixes itself, or it's something that we can handle ourselves. But whatever it is, we're trying to do it without the interference of outsiders, mm-hmm. so to speak. So
I think that you've hit on, in my mind, the most important point that I would want to make today being here, is that up until the age of 3, your child is being served under what's called an IFSP, an Individual Family Service Plan.
Individual Family Service Plan, okay.
It is all about how do we support the family and the child's development. You can utilize those services and choose never to go any further with the school district at age 3.
So it's not an automatic thing that if your child is under this IFSP plan, that when the child goes to school, he's taking some baggage with him.
Correct. Because what will happen is at around age 2.5, we do what's called transition planning. We introduce the family to the district, let them learn what the district would do mm-hmm. in order to determine if the child would be eligible at age 3. After that meeting and that transition planning, it is the family's choice to pursue additional assessments with the district and whether they want to move forward to see if the child would qualify for an IEP, mm-hmm. an individual education program.
Mm-hmm.
So the F goes away. The family part goes away. It's all about working directly with the child to reach educational goals.
And then does the focus after age 3 become the school and the child's behavior in school? Is that the focus then? As opposed to more the parents' interaction with the child and the home environment. Is that how it separates?
So, yeah, basically the focus for an IEP is a student, and not so much on the family.
Family. Mm-hmm.
In addition to, there's probably two kind of sessions going on. You know, one will be for the education system for mm-hmm. possible special education services.
Right.
And then the regional center will do at 3 their own assessment to determine eligibility for their system too as well.
Oh, so there is continuing services through the regional center?
Yes, there could be.
Oh, there are. There could be.
There could be.
Okay. But a new assessment takes place at age 3? Is that my understanding?
Because the laws change at 3 for the regional center system. And again, I spoke earlier about the Lanerman Act. Basically, that determines after 3 who's eligible for regional center services.
So till 3, the parent can come in and say, I think there are some developmental delays that I'm concerned about. The regional center is going to look at it not from a diagnostic point of view, but simply as an eligibility to certain services point of view.
That's correct.
Am I understanding it correctly?
To make it as clear as possible, what we're going to determine is at what age level is your child in their development in all 5 developmental domains. We're looking at motor.
Motor skills,
which is gross and fine motor, your hearing and your vision.
Mm-hmm.
We're looking at communication, not only how you communicate, but how you understand language, your social development, your cognitive development, and your adaptive self-help skills. We're going to figure out on a developmental test mm-hmm. where your child is at an age level. If your child is showing a specific delay that it's our criteria to meet that certain number, for example, 33% below their age level, then they qualify.
Okay.
It's not based on a medical diagnosis. It's purely based on, we know that if your delay is above a certain point, mm-hmm. that intervention can be helpful.
So can you also talk about, and I think we didn't talk about, and I want to catch it before we run out of time, but can you talk about how early intervention actually helps, how it can make a difference?
You want me to take that one? You know, we tried today to see if we could find a parent who's been through the program and was available to call in, because there's no one better to encourage a parent to pursue this than another parent that's gone through it.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the families that have been in our program talk about how early intervention was the first time somebody said something positive about their child, that they felt like they could now go to the park and not worry about someone not playing with their child,
mm-hmm.
that they were given ideas because the program came to their home, worked with the child in his natural environment. First time the child was able to sit down for a meal with the family.
Mm-hmm.
These are really important things, not only for child development, but for the family unit as a whole. Because what we know and what research has shown is that a child's development does not happen outside of the family unit. So if we're not helping the family on the child's development, mm-hmm. we're really not addressing the issue, especially on children birth to five.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I also want to say, too, that, you know, with all this research on brain development, that birth to three is such a critical time.
Mm-hmm.
And they're finding this now, that the brain's development connections and lifelong connections are really important at that age, through that age period.
Mm-hmm.
So the early intervention helps to create that, in addition to relationships and to the parents' attachment to that child, too, as well,
mm-hmm.
which will be lifelong for this child.
And I, what I got from your previous statement, Michelle, is that it's such a relief for parents to know that, you know, there is something that they can help with. It's not unusual, first of all. They're not the only ones going through the problem. There are other kids with similar issues. There are modalities to help the child.
Absolutely. And I think what's so key is that the most successful part of early intervention is that the parents are getting that support. In addition to the therapeutic services that Howard mentioned, there's also support services for the parent. You know, the county office program where I am, we have a family support counselor. We have a psychologist that works with the parents. So they really start to feel like, I know what my child needs.
Mm-hmm.
And as a parent feels more confident and feels less stressed, that's going to make them more capable of working on their child's development.
And I just want to quickly understand before we wind up that the schism that happens at age three and how the transition happens. So could you just elaborate on that again?
So basically, as we discussed earlier, that at 2 years, 6 months, when the child's in early start, we start this transition process out of early start, meaning that we make contact with the local school district. We actually have a meeting with a district representative, and we talk about each step on, you know, the eligibility process possibly for special education services at that time. We also discuss the process through the regional center system, too. If a child may qualify after three and what the eligibility criteria is for that system, too, as well. So there could be, again, two kind of assessments for eligibility going on prior to the age of three. So at three, then, when early start ends,
mm-hmm.
a child could be eligible for services through their local district and also, too, through the regional center system as well.
Okay. And after that, even though there's a gap between age three, and I think we discussed this earlier in our phone conversation, but the child actually starts going to school only at five and not three. How does the school get involved at that point?
Special education services, if a child is identified at age three, they typically are what they call special day classes or center-based services.
I see.
So if a child qualifies for special education at age three, the school districts or the county offices of education would be providing what a parent would call school. It might be a two-day-a-week, a three-day-a-week, or a five-day-a-week classroom.
So in a sense, they're getting a little bit of an advantage.
Absolutely.
An early advantage. I can see how critical it is to get into at least talking to people at the regional centers. Is there a website, Howard, that parents can go to get more information about the regional centers and the Early Start program? Both of you can share with me.
Every regional center has a website. So I think for this area, it's www.rceb.org.
So if they Google Regional Center of East Bay, they would be able to find the website.
Yeah.
And for the education system, if you're going in after age three, you would go to Alameda County Office of Education, and they have a website.
Alameda County Office of Education, okay.
And a really quick thing I'd love to share for those families that really want more information on development but really don't want to call what they call the system yet, I want to share two really good websites they can go to.
Mm-hmm.
One is 0to3.org.
So 0to3, and how do you write? It's all words.
All words, 0to3.org, and they have a series of 12 podcasts all about early child development. And another good website is cdc.gov, the Center for Disease Control.
Oh, okay. CDC, how do they get involved in it?
So cdc.gov has an amazing link on their website called Learn the Signs and Act Early.
Learn the Signs and Act Early.
So these are two mm-hmm. websites that any parent can go to and look at different stages of development, what typically children are doing. And if you look at that and say, my kiddo's not doing that, then maybe that gives you a little more information and make you feel a little more comfortable knowing if you want to pursue a referral or not.
And one last resource, too. Every area has what's called a family resource center.
Okay.
So, and basically what this resource center is there to support families with special needs with support groups, information, any kind of literature is there. So
when can anybody go, or does that have to be some diagnosis of the child before
a parent? Anybody can go. They're open to the community. Yeah, so.
They're open to the community, and it doesn't matter if there has been no previous diagnosis or anything of the child.
No.
Family just goes there to get help. That's fabulous resources. And parents, if you've been listening, hopefully our guests gave you a sense of how many resources there are in the system for you to check out, and how important early intervention is, and what are the resources that are available to parents. I'd like to thank both our guests, Michelle and Howard, for appearing on the show. Thank you, Michelle. Thank you, Howard.
Thank you.
And we'll try and put up some of the information on our Parent Talk page, indiacc.org/parenttalk. I want to take a quick break, and we have a few minutes left. I'd like to share with you a workshop for teenagers with special needs on helping them find a transition out of high school and into college. In our earlier segments, we've been talking about early childhood development and how early intervention for special needs can make a big difference in a child's life. Right now, I'm going to be talking, I have on the line with me Priya Kshetrapal, who is one of the organizers of a workshop that is coming up that is titled Teens on the Spectrum, Entering the Workforce, Self-Sufficiency, and Life Skills. So we are doing something a little bit different. Welcome, Priya. Are you on the line?
Yes, I am. Hi.
Hi. Tell us a little bit about this workshop. It's coming up. What's the date?
It is coming up on Saturday, March 10th.
March 10th.
It is in John F. Kennedy University in Pleasant Hill from 8:30 a.m. to 4 p.m.
Okay. And is there a website where people can get that information?
Yes. If you would just go to www.orionacademy.org. That's O-R-I-O-N academy.org.
So tell us a little bit about the workshop. Now, this is, as I understand it, for teens on the autistic spectrum.
Yes, it's basically for children or teenagers on the spectrum who are planning to transition from high school into college or junior college, or just basically vocational colleges or living skills, anything that is going to facilitate their move from high school into the real world, quote unquote. There will be people who will be very qualified people who will be talking about the laws that impact you before and after high school, the overview of the services and programs that are available for children, the post-secondary options, and social skills. The big thing what happens with these children is the self-esteem issues which creep up.
Mm-hmm.
Because they've been going through a lot of stuff all through middle school and high school.
Right.
And then how to cope with that? Are they capable of living on their own? What kind of options are available for them? Are they ready to be independent, going to a dorm? Are they ready to kind of live perhaps in assisted colleges? There's one called CLE, College Living Experience, for example. Orion Academy is starting something called Bridge to College, which will also be a place where children on the spectrum after high school have a safe place, essentially, to figure out how to cope with living experiences outside of their parents' home and then transition into a real college experience if they want to.
Right. I actually feel that this transition from high school to college is difficult even for neurotypical kids.
Yes.
Because suddenly, at some arbitrary cutoff point, we are saying, now you can manage on your own. It's like pushing the child out of the nest. And I can imagine it must be even much more challenging for kids who are used to having a lot of help and a lot of structure in their life.
Yes. It is actually almost the fear level is what almost paralyzes them. The anxiety factor increases, as you would probably notice with anybody who has a child in this genre. The anxiety factor really creeps in around 16, 17, and 18, and plus the teenagers, so they're having all those hormones going in as well.
Right.
So there's a lot of stuff going in, and so to support them, or to even to support the parents to understand what are the options available for you, what can you do? I mean, it's not, as Indian parents, I'm an Indian parent, I know that for me the generic form is, oh, my son will do his SATs and then go off to college.
Right.
But, what if he cannot?
Right.
What are my options? Can I send him to vocational colleges?
Mm-hmm.
Where is he going to live? And then after that 2-year, 4-year program, whatever he studies, then what happens?
Mm-hmm.
What kind of jobs do they get? So we have this fantastic speaker this time called Ashley Stanford.
Mm-hmm.
She will be talking about the kind of careers that can turn into can it be supported by our kids.
Mm-hmm.
And then also she will be giving you examples of positions from over 35 fields where these kids just basically slide in because, you know, some of them have skills which are really needed.
Very complementary to that particular job.
Yes.
Yes. Who are the kind of people, the professionals, who are the kind of professionals who will be coming to this workshop to talk to the parents?
We have Dr. Catherine Stewart, who is the director of Orion Academy.
Mm-hmm.
She has published many books on Asperger's and NLD, and she's basically a savant in this area.
Mm-hmm.
We have Dr. Andrew Schlegelmilch, who is also a psychotherapist who works with only kids on the spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
We have Dr. Ashley Stanford, who is the author and CEO of a computer company, actually, believe it or not. And she has written multiple books, and she's on Amazon. And she will be talking about all the kind of companies which basically assist children into, you know, easing into the workforce.
Will there also be people from colleges?
Yes. So the other aspect of it will be, and there's one more person called Will Stanford. He is the person who actually places teens on the spectrum into the work. He has a placement agency for kids on the spectrum and adults as well.
This is a placement from high school to college or college to workforce?
From college to workforce or okay. High school to workforce.
Mm-hmm.
It just depends what stage you are at. And then on the other end, we have exhibitors who will be talking about or will they have their booths and there will be transitional colleges in there. Some college consultants who really only assist parents with children on the spectrum, SAT prep schools with one-to-one tutoring skills, a nutritional consultant, social skill camps, and then a new vendor just signed up recently, and that group basically kind of offers you services in any sphere, could be academic, could be social, with a one-to-one consulting with the child.
So there are a lot of resources for parents of teenagers who are exhibiting some special needs to figure out how the child will make the transition into the world of college and then later into the world of the workforce.
Yes. And plus, Vidya, I think what really happens is when you're in a community like this, you know, you're here to stay. This is us.
Mm-hmm.
It is really good to know that all these resources are available. I am a sophomore parent, and for me to kind of know that I have all these options available and all the experts who are willing to kind of see me through the process is reassuring. I don't know what's going to happen to my child. I don't know if he's going to, you know, become the next president of the USA. But the point is to know that there are all these people who are able and willing to support me and guide me through the process.
Mm-hmm.
That's really the key at this point.
I think at any rate, it would be fantastic to hear from the experts on the subject, people who have studied this and people who have some real insight to offer. Is there a cost to this workshop?
Yes, it is going to cost $100 per person, lunch is included. It is from 8:30 a.m. to 4 p.m., and the 800 number to call and kind of sign up is 800-577-1384.
Let's repeat that number for our listeners.
Yes, 800-577-1384. Or they can even go to www.orionacademy.org.
Thank you so much, Priya. We're coming to the end of our show today. Thank you for telling us about the workshop.
My pleasure.
And listeners, next week we're going to take on a much less serious subject, something more fun. We're going to be talking about Youth Sava, the dance competition that's run by the India Community Center every week. And with that, I bid you bye-bye and see you next week.